Harper Audio presents The 20th Century, A People's History, by Howard Zinn, read by Matt Damon, with an introduction and inclusion read by Howard Zinn.
My book, A People's History of the United States, started with Christopher Columbus and ended in the mid-1970s. This recording, drawn from the latter half of that book, is intended for the listener who wants to concentrate on this century. It's also an opportunity for me to carry the story further, into the 1990s, with several new sections, including one on the Clinton presidency. But I must explain my point of view. It's obvious in the very first pages of the larger People's History, when I tell about Columbus, and emphasize not his navigational skill and fortitude in making his way to the Western Hemisphere, but his cruel treatment of the Indians he found here, torturing them, exterminating them in his greed for gold, his desperation to bring riches to his patrons back in Spain. In other words, my focus is not on the achievements of the heroes of traditional history, but on all those people who were the victims of those achievements, who suffered silently or fought back magnificently. To emphasize the heroism of Columbus and his successors as navigators and discoverers, and to de-emphasize their genocide, is not a technical necessity, but an ideological choice. It serves unwittingly to justify what was done. My point is not that we must, in telling history, accuse, judge, condemn Columbus in absentia. It's too late for that. It would be a useless scholarly exercise in morality. But the easy acceptance of atrocities as a deplorable but necessary price to pay for progress, Hiroshima and Vietnam to save Western civilization, Kronstadt and Hungary to save socialism, nuclear proliferation to save us all. That is still with us. One reason these atrocities are still with us is that we have learned to bury them in a mass of other facts, as radioactive wastes are buried in containers in the earth. We have learned to give them exactly the same proportion of attention that teachers and writers often give them in the most respectable of classrooms and textbooks. This learned sense of moral proportion, coming from the apparent objectivity of the scholar, is accepted more easily than when it comes from politicians at press conferences. It is therefore more deadly. The treatment of heroes, Columbus, and their victims, the Arawaks, the quiet acceptance of conquest and murder in the name of progress, is only one aspect of a certain approach to history, in which the past is told from the point of view of governments, conquerors, diplomats, leaders. It is as if they, like Columbus, deserve universal acceptance, as if they, the founding fathers, Jackson, Lincoln, Wilson, Roosevelt, Kennedy, the leading members of Congress, the famous justices of the Supreme Court, represent the nation as a whole. The pretense is that there really is such a thing as the United States, subject to occasional conflicts and quarrels, but fundamentally a community of people with common interests. It is as if there really is a national interest, represented in the Constitution, in territorial expansion, in the laws passed by Congress, the decisions of the courts, the development of capitalism, the culture of education and the mass media. History is the memory of states, wrote Henry Kissinger in his first book, A World Restored, in which he proceeded to tell the history of 19th century Europe from the viewpoint of the leaders of Austria and England, ignoring the millions who suffered from those statesmen's policies. From his standpoint, the peace that Europe had before the French Revolution was restored by the diplomacy of a few national leaders. But for factory workers in England, farmers in France, colored people in Asia and Africa, women and children everywhere, except in the upper classes. It was a world of conquest, violence, hunger, exploitation. A world not restored, but disintegrated. My viewpoint in telling the history of the United States is different, that we must not accept the memory of states as our own. Nations are not communities and never have been. The history of any country, presented as the history of a family, conceals fierce conflicts of interest, sometimes exploding, most often repressed, between conquerors and conquered, masters and slaves, capitalists and workers, dominators and dominated in race and sex. And in such a world of conflict, a world of victims and executioners, it is the job of thinking people, as Albert Camus suggested, not to be on the side of the executioners. Thus, in that inevitable taking of sides which comes from selection and emphasis in history, I prefer to try to tell the story of the discovery of America from the viewpoint of the Arawaks, of the Constitution from the standpoint of the slaves, of Andrew Jackson as seen by the Cherokees, of the Civil War as seen by the New York Irish, of the Mexican War as seen by the deserting soldiers of Scott's army, of the rise of industrialism as seen by the young women in the Lowell textile mills, of the Spanish-American War as seen by the Cubans, the conquest of the Philippines as seen by black soldiers on Luzon, the Gilded Age as seen by Southern farmers, the First World War as seen by socialists, the Second World War as seen by pacifists, the New Deal as seen by blacks in Harlem, the post-war American empire as seen by peons in Latin America, and so on, to the limited extent that any one person, however he or she strains, can see history from the standpoint of others. My point is not to grieve for the victims and denounce the executioners. Those tears, that anger, cast into the past, deplete our moral energy for the present. And the lines are not always clear. In the long run, the oppressor is also a victim. In the short run, and so far human history has consisted only of short runs, the victims, themselves desperate and tainted with the culture that oppresses them, turn on other victims. Still, understanding the complexities, this book will be skeptical of governments and their attempts through politics and culture to ensnare ordinary people in a giant web of nationhood pretending to a common interest. I will try not to overlook the cruelties that victims inflict on one another as they are jammed together in the boxcars of the system. I don't want to romanticize them, but I do remember, in rough paraphrase, a statement I once read. The cry of the poor is not always just, but if you don't listen to it, you will never know what justice is. I don't want to invent victories for people's movements, but to think that history writing must aim simply to recapitulate the failures that dominate the past is to make historians collaborators in an endless cycle of defeat. If history is to be creative, to anticipate a possible future without denying the past, it should, I believe, emphasize new possibilities by disclosing those hidden episodes of the past when, even if in brief flashes, people show their ability to resist, to join together, occasionally to win. I am supposing, or perhaps only hoping, that our future may be found in the past's fugitive moments of compassion rather than in its solid centuries of warfare. That, being as blunt as I can, is my approach to the history of the United States. The listener may as well know that before going on.
The Black Revolt of the 1950s and 1960s, North and South, came as a surprise. But perhaps it should not have. The memory of oppressed people is one thing that cannot be taken away. And for such people, with such memories, revolt is always an inch below the surface. For blacks in the United States, there was the memory of slavery, and after that of segregation, lynching, humiliation. And it was not just a memory, but a living presence, part of the daily lives of blacks in generation after generation. In the 1930s, Langston Hughes wrote a poem, Lenox Avenue Mural. What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun, or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat, or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet? Maybe it just sags like a heavy load, or does it explode? In a society of complex controls, both crude and refined, secret thoughts can often be found in the arts, and so it was in black society. Perhaps the blues, however pathetic, concealed anger, and the jazz, however joyful, portended rebellion. And then the poetry, the thoughts no longer so secret. In the 1920s, Claude McKay, one of the figures of what came to be called the Harlem Renaissance, wrote a poem that Henry Cabot Lodge put in the Congressional Record as an example of dangerous currents among young blacks. If we must die, let it not be like hogs, hunted and penned in an inglorious spot. Like men, we'll face the murderous, cowardly pack, pressed to the wall, dying, but fighting back. County Cullen's poem, Incident, evoked memories, all different, all the same, out of every black American's childhood. Once riding in old Baltimore, heart-filled, head-filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger, and so I smiled, but he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember. At the time of the Scottsboro Boys incident, Cullen wrote a bitter poem noting that white poets had used their pens to protest in other cases of injustice. But now that blacks were involved, most were silent. His last stanza was, "Surely, I said, now will the poets sing, but they have raised no cry. I wonder why." Even outward subservience, Uncle Tom behavior in real situations, the comic or fawning Negro on the stage, the self-ridicule, the caution, concealed resentment, anger, energy. The black poet Paul Laurence Dunbar, in the era of the black minstrel around the turn of the century, wrote, "We wear the mask. We wear the mask that grins and lies. It hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. We sing, but oh, the clay is vile beneath our feet and long the mile. But let the world dream otherwise. We wear the mask." Two black performers of that time played the minstrel and satirized it at the same time. When Burt Williams and George Walker billed themselves as two real coons, they were, Nathan Huggins says, intending to give style and comic dignity to a fiction that white men had created. By the 1930s, the mask was off for many black poets. Langston Hughes wrote, "I Too." "I too sing America. I am the darker brother. They send me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I laugh and eat well and grow strong. Tomorrow I'll be at the table when company comes." Gwendolyn Bennett wrote, "I want to see live Negro girls etched dark against the sky while sunset lingers. I want to hear the chanting around a heathen fire of a strange black race. I want to feel the surging of my sad people's soul hidden by a minstrel smile." There was Margaret Walker's prose poem, For My People. "Let a new earth rise, let another world be born, let a bloody peace be written in the sky, let a second generation full of courage issue forth, let a people loving freedom come to growth, let a beauty full of healing and a strength of final clenching be the pulsing in our spirits and our blood. Let the martial songs be written. Let the dirges disappear. Let a race of men now rise and take control. By the 1940s, there was Richard Wright, a gifted novelist, a black man. His autobiography of 1937, Black Boy, gave endless insights. For instance, how blacks were set against one another, when he told how he was prodded to fight another black boy for the amusement of white men. Black Boy expressed unashamedly every humiliation, and then... The White South said that it knew niggers, and I was what the White South called a nigger. Well, the White South had never known me, never known what I thought, what I felt. The White South said that I had a place in life. Well, I had never felt my place. Or rather, my deepest instincts had always made me reject the place to which the White South had assigned me. It had never occurred to me that I was in any way an inferior being, and no word that I had ever heard fall from the lips of Southern white men had ever made me really doubt the worth of my own humanity. It was all there in the poetry, the prose, the music, sometimes masked, sometimes unmistakably clear, the signs of a people unbeaten, waiting, hot, coiled. In Black Boy, Wright told about the training of black children in America to keep them silent, but also, how do Negroes feel about the way they have to live? How do they discuss it when alone among themselves? I think this question can be answered in a single sentence. A friend of mine who ran an elevator once told me, "Lord, man, if it wasn't for them polices and them old lynch mobs, there wouldn't be nothing but uproar down here." Richard Wright, for a time, joined the Communist Party. He tells of this period of his life and his disillusionment with the party in The God That Failed. The Communist Party was known to pay special attention to the problem of race equality. When the Scottsboro case unfolded in the 1930s in Alabama, it was the Communist Party that had become associated with the defense of these young black men imprisoned in the early years of the Depression by Southern injustice. The party was accused by liberals and the NAACP of exploiting the issue for its own purposes, and there was a half-truth in it. But black people were realistic about the difficulty of having white allies who were pure in motive. The other half of the truth was that black communists in the South had earned the admiration of blacks by their organizing work against enormous obstacles. There was Hosea Hudson, the black organizer of the unemployed in Birmingham, for instance. And in Georgia in 1932, a 19-year-old black youth named Angelo Herndon, whose father died of miner's pneumonia, who had worked in mines as a boy in Kentucky, joined an unemployment council in Birmingham organized by the Communist Party, and then joined the party. He wrote later, "All my life I'd been sweated and stepped on and Jim Crowed. I lay on my belly in the mines for a few dollars a week and saw my pay stolen and slashed and my buddies killed. I lived in the worst section of town and rode behind the colored signs on streetcars as though there was something disgusting about me. I heard myself called nigger, and I had to say yes, sir, to every white man, whether tested it, but I had never known that anything could be done about it. And here, all of a sudden, I had found organizations in which Negroes and whites sat together and worked together and knew no difference of race or color." Herndon became a Communist Party organizer in Atlanta. He and his fellow communists organized block committees of unemployment councils in 1932, which got rent relief for needy people. They organized a demonstration to which 1,000 people came, 600 of them white, and the next day the city voted $6,000 in relief to the jobless. But soon after that, Herndon was arrested, held incommunicado, and charged with violating a Georgia statute against insurrection. He recalled his trial. "The state of Georgia displayed the literature that had been taken from my room and read passages of it to the jury. They questioned me in great detail. Did I believe that the bosses in government ought to pay insurance to unemployed workers? That Negroes should have complete equality with white people? Did I believe in the demand for the self-determination of the Black Belt, that the Negro people should be allowed to rule the Black Belt territory, kicking out the white landlords and government officials? Did I feel that the working class could run the mills and mines in government, that it wasn't necessary to have bosses at all? I told them I believed all of that, and more." Herndon was convicted and spent 5 years in prison, until in 1937 the Supreme Court ruled unconstitutional the Georgia statute under which he was found guilty. It was men like him who represented to the establishment a dangerous militancy among blacks, made more dangerous when linked with the Communist Party. There were others who made that same connection, magnifying the danger. Benjamin Davis, the black lawyer who defended Herndon at his trial, nationally renowned men like singer and actor Paul Robeson, and writer and scholar W.E.B. Du Bois, who did not hide their support and sympathy for the Communist Party. The Negro was not as anti-communist as the white population. He could not afford to be. His friends were so few. So that Herndon, Davis, Robeson, Du Bois, however their political views might be maligned by the country as a whole, found admiration for their fighting spirit in the black community. The black militant mood, flashing here and there in the 30s, was reduced to a subsurface simmering during World War II, when the nation on the one hand denounced racism, and on the other hand maintained segregation in the armed forces and kept blacks in low-paying jobs. When the war ended, a new element entered the racial balance in the United States, the enormous, unprecedented upsurge of black and yellow people in Africa and Asia. President Harry Truman had to reckon with this, especially as the Cold War rivalry with the Soviet Union began, and the dark-skinned revolt of former colonies all over the world threatened to take Marxist form. Action on the race question was needed, not just to calm a black population at home emboldened by war promises, frustrated by the basic sameness of their condition. It was needed to present to the world a United States that could counter the continuous communist thrust at the most flagrant failure of American society, the race question. What Du Bois had said long ago, unnoticed, now loomed large in 1945. The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. President Harry Truman, in late 1946, appointed a committee on civil rights, which recommended that the civil rights section of the Department of Justice be expanded, that there be a permanent commission on civil rights, that Congress pass laws against lynching and to stop voting discrimination, and suggested new laws to end racial discrimination in jobs. Truman's committee was blunt about its motivation in making these recommendations. Yes, it said, there was moral reason, a matter of conscience. But there was also an economic reason. Discrimination was costly to the country, wasteful of its talent. And perhaps most important, there was an international reason. Our position in the post-war world is so vital to the future that our smallest actions have far-reaching effects. We cannot escape the fact that our civil rights record has been an issue in world politics. The world's press and radio are full of it. Those with competing philosophies have stressed and are shamelessly distorting our shortcomings. They have tried to prove our democracy an empty fraud and our nation a consistent oppressor of underprivileged people. This may seem ludicrous to Americans, but it is sufficiently important to worry our friends. The United States is not so strong. The final triumph of the democratic ideal is not so inevitable that we can ignore what the world thinks of us or our record. The United States was out in the world now in a way it had never been. The stakes were large. World supremacy. And, as Truman's committee said, our smallest actions have far-reaching effects. And so the United States went ahead to take small actions, hoping they would have large effects. Congress did not move to enact the legislation asked for by the Committee on Civil Rights. But Truman, 4 months before the presidential election of 1948, and challenged from the left in that election by Progressive Party candidate Henry Wallace, issued an executive order asking that the armed forces, segregated in World War II, institute policies of racial equality as rapidly as possible. The order may have been prompted not only by the election, but by the need to maintain black morale in the armed forces as the possibility of war grew. It took over a decade to complete the desegregation in the military. Truman could have issued executive orders in other areas, but did not. The 14th and 15th Amendments, plus the set of laws passed in the late 1860s and early 1870s, gave the president enough authority to wipe out racial discrimination. The Constitution demanded that the president execute the laws, but no president had used that power. Neither did Truman. For instance, he asked Congress for legislation prohibiting discrimination in interstate transportation facilities, but specific legislation in 1887 already barred discrimination in interstate transportation and had never been enforced by executive action. Meanwhile, the Supreme Court was taking steps. 90 years after the Constitution had been amended to establish racial equality, to move toward that end. During the war, it ruled that the white primary used to exclude blacks from voting in the Democratic Party primaries, which in the South were really the elections, was unconstitutional. In 1954, the court finally struck down the separate but equal doctrine that it had defended since the 1890s. The NAACP brought a series of cases before the court to challenge segregation in the public schools, and now in Brown versus the Board of Education, the court said the separation of school children generates a feeling of inferiority that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. In the field of public education, it said, the doctrine of separate but equal has no place. The court did not insist on immediate change. A year later, it said that segregated facilities should be integrated with all deliberate speed. By 1965, 10 years after the all deliberate speed guideline, more than 75% of the school districts in the South remained segregated. Still, it was a dramatic decision, and the message went around the world in 1954 that the American government had outlawed segregation. In the United States, too, for those not thinking about the customary gap between word and fact, it was an exhilarating sign of change. What to others seemed but progress, to blacks, was apparently not enough. In the early 1960s, black people rose in rebellion all over the South. And in the late 1960s, they were engaging in wild insurrection in 100 northern cities. It was all a surprise to those without that deep memory of slavery, that everyday presence of humiliation, registered in the poetry, the music, the occasional outbursts of anger, the more frequent sullen silences. Part of that memory was of words uttered, laws passed, decisions made, which turned out to be meaningless. For such a people, with such a memory, and such daily recapitulation of history, revolt was always minutes away, in a timing mechanism which no one had set, but which might go off with some unpredictable set of events. Those events came at the end of 1955 in the capital city of Alabama, Montgomery. 3 months after her arrest, Mrs. Rosa Parks, a 43-year-old seamstress, explained why she refused to obey the Montgomery law providing for segregation on city buses, why she decided to sit down in the white section of the bus. Well, in the first place, I had been working all day on the job. I was quite tired after spending a full day working. I handle and work on clothing that white people wear. That didn't come in my mind, but this is what I wanted to know. When and how would we ever determine our rights as human beings? It just happened that the driver made a demand, and I just didn't feel like obeying his demand. He called a policeman, and I was arrested and placed in jail. Montgomery blacks called a mass meeting. They voted to boycott all city buses. Carpools were organized to take Negroes to work. Most people walked. The city retaliated by indicting 100 leaders of the boycott and sent many to jail. White segregationists turned to violence. Bombs exploded in 4 Negro churches. A shotgun blast was fired through the front door of the home of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., the 27-year-old Atlanta-born minister who was one of the leaders of the boycott. King's home was bombed, but the black people of Montgomery persisted, and in November 1956, the Supreme Court outlawed segregation on local bus lines. Montgomery was the beginning. It forecast the style and mood of the vast protest movement that would sweep the South in the next 10 years. Emotional church meetings, Christian hymns adapted to current battles, references to lost American ideals, the commitment to nonviolence, the willingness to struggle and sacrifice. A New York Times reporter described a mass meeting in Montgomery during the boycott. One after the other, indicted Negro leaders took the rostrum in a crowded Baptist church tonight to urge their followers to shun the city's buses and walk with God. More than 2,000 Negroes filled the church from basement to balcony and overflowed into the street. They chanted and sang. They shouted and prayed. They collapsed in the aisles and they sweltered in an 85-degree heat. They pledged themselves again and again to passive resistance. Under this banner, they have carried on for 80 days a stubborn boycott of the city's buses. Martin Luther King at that meeting gave a preview of the oratory that would soon inspire millions of people to demand racial justice. He said the protest was not merely over buses, but over things that go deep down into the archives of history. He said, "We have known humiliation. We have known abusive language. We have been plunged into the abyss of oppression. And we decided to raise up only with the weapon of protest. It is one of the greatest glories of America that we have the right of protest. If we are arrested every day, if we are exploited every day, if we are trampled over every day, don't ever let anyone pull you so low as to hate them. We must use the weapon of love. We must have compassion and understanding for those who hate us. We must realize so many people are taught to hate us that they are not totally responsible for their hate. But we stand in life at midnight. We are always on the threshold of a new dawn." King's stress on love and nonviolence was powerfully effective in building a sympathetic following throughout the nation, among whites as well as blacks. But there were blacks who thought the message naive, that while there were misguided people who might be won over by love, there were others who would have to be bitterly fought, and not always with nonviolence. 2 years after the Montgomery boycott in Monroe, North Carolina, an ex-Marine named Robert Williams, the president of the local NAACP, became known for his view that blacks should defend themselves against violence, with guns if necessary. When local Klansmen attacked the home of one of the leaders of the Monroe NAACP, Williams and other blacks, armed with rifles, fired back. The Klan left. The Klan was being challenged now with its own tactic of violence. A Klan raid on an Indian community in North Carolina was repelled by Indians firing rifles. Still, in the years that followed, Southern blacks stressed nonviolence. On February 1, 1960, four freshmen at a Negro college in Greensboro, North Carolina, decided to sit down at the Woolworth's lunch counter downtown, where only whites ate. They were refused service, and when they would not leave, the lunch counter was closed for the day. The next day they returned, and then, day after day, other Negroes came to sit silently. In the next 2 weeks, sit-ins spread to 15 cities in 5 southern states. A 17-year-old sophomore at Spelman College in Atlanta, Ruby Doris Smith, heard about Greensboro. When the student committee was formed, I told my older sister to put me on the list. And when 200 students were selected for the first demonstration, I was among them. I went through the food line in the restaurant at the state capitol with 6 other students, but when we got to the cashier, she wouldn't take our money. The lieutenant governor came down and told us to leave. We didn't and went to the county jail. In his Harlem apartment in New York, a young Negro teacher of mathematics named Bob Moses saw a photo in the newspapers of the Greensboro sit-inners. The students in that picture had a certain look on their faces, sort of sullen, angry, determined. Before, the Negro in the South had always looked on the defensive, cringing. This time they were taking the initiative. They were kids my age, and I knew this had something to do with my own life. There was violence against the sit-inner, but the idea of taking the initiative against segregation took hold. In the next 12 months, more than 50,000 people, mostly black, some white, participated in demonstrations of one kind or another in 100 cities, and over 3,600 people were put in jail. But by the end of 1960, lunch counters were open to blacks in Greensboro and many other places. A year after the Greensboro incident, a northern-based group dedicated to racial equality, CORE, Congress of Racial Equality, organized freedom rides in which blacks and whites traveled together on buses going through the South to try to break the segregation pattern in interstate travel. Such segregation had long been illegal, but the federal government never enforced the law in the South. The president now was John F. Kennedy, but he too seemed cautious about the race question, concerned about the support of Southern white leaders of the Democratic Party. The two buses that left Washington, D.C. on May 4, 1961, headed for New Orleans, never got there. In South Carolina, riders were beaten. In Alabama, a bus was set afire. Freedom riders were attacked with fists and iron bars. The Southern police did not interfere with any of this violence, nor did the federal government. FBI agents watched, took notes, did nothing. At this point, veterans of the sit-ins, who had recently formed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, dedicated to nonviolent but militant action for equal rights, organized another freedom ride from Nashville to Birmingham. Before they started out, they called the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C., to ask for protection. As Ruby Dora Smith reported, the Justice Department said no, they couldn't protect anyone, but if something happened, they would investigate. You know how they do. The racially mixed SNCC Freedom Riders were arrested in Birmingham, Alabama, spent a night in jail, were taken to the Tennessee border by police, made their way back to Birmingham, took a bus to Montgomery, and there were attacked by whites with fists and clubs in a bloody scene. They resumed their trip to Jackson, Mississippi. By this time, the Freedom Riders were in the news all over the world, and the government was anxious to prevent further violence. Attorney General Robert Kennedy, instead of insisting on their right to travel without being arrested, agreed to the Freedom Riders being arrested in Jackson in return for Mississippi police protection against possible mob violence. As Victor Navosky comments in Kennedy Justice about Robert Kennedy, he didn't hesitate to trade the Freedom Riders' constitutional right to interstate travel for Senator Eastland's guarantee of their right to live. The Freedom Riders did not become subdued in jail. They resisted, protested, sang, demanded their rights. Stokely Carmichael recalled later how he and his fellow inmates were singing in the Parchman Jail in Mississippi, and the sheriff threatened to take away their mattresses. "I hung on to the mattress and said, 'I think we have a right to them, and I think you're unjust.' And he said, 'I don't want to hear all that shit, nigger,' and started to put on the wrist breakers. I wouldn't move and started to sing, 'I'm going to tell God how you treat me.' And everybody started to sing it. And by this time, Tyson was really to pieces. He called to the trustees, 'Get him in there.' And he went out the door and slammed it and left everybody else with their mattresses." In Albany, Georgia, a small deep south town where the atmosphere of slavery still lingered, mass demonstrations took place in the winter of 1961 and again in 1962. Of 22,000 black people in Albany, over 1,000 went to jail for marching, assembling, to protest segregation and discrimination. Here, as in all the demonstrations that would sweep over the South, little black children participated. A new generation was learning to act. The Albany police chief, after one of the mass arrests, was taking the names of prisoners lined up before his desk. He looked up and saw a Negro boy, about 9 years old. "What's your name?" The boy looked straight at him and said, "Freedom, freedom." There is no way of measuring the effect of that Southern movement on the sensibilities of a whole generation of young black people, or of tracing the process by which some of them became activists and leaders. In Lee County, Georgia, after the events of 1961-1962, a black teenager named James Crawford joined SNCC and began taking black people to the county courthouse to vote. One day, bringing a woman there, he was approached by the deputy registrar. Another SNCC worker took notes on the conversation. "Registrar, what do you want?" "Crawford, I brought this lady down to register." Registrar, after giving the woman a card to fill out and sending her outside in the hall. "Why did you bring this lady down here?" "Crawford, because she wants to be a first-class citizen like y'all." "Registrar, who are you to bring people down to register?" "Crawford, it's my job." "Registrar, suppose you get 2 bullets in your head right now." "Crawford, I gotta die anyhow." "Registrar, if I don't do it, I can get somebody else to do it." No reply. "Registrar, are you scared?" "Crawford, no." "Registrar, Suppose somebody came in that door and shoot you in the back of the head right now. What would you do? Crawford, I couldn't do nothing. If they shoot me in the back of the head, there are people coming from all over the world. Registrar, what people? Crawford, the people I work for. In Birmingham in 1963, thousands of blacks went into the streets, facing police clubs, tear gas, dogs, high-powered water hoses. And meanwhile, all over the Deep South, the young people of SNCC, mostly black, a few white, were moving into communities in Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas. Joined by local black people, they were organizing to register people to vote, to protest against racism, to build up courage against violence. The Department of Justice recorded 1,412 demonstrations in 3 months of 1963. Imprisonment became commonplace. Beatings became frequent. Many local people were afraid. Others came forward. A 19-year-old black student from Illinois named Carver Neblett, working for SNCC in Terrell County, Georgia, reported, I talked with a blind man who is extremely interested in the civil rights movement. He's been keeping up with the movement from the beginning. Even though this man is blind, he wants to learn all the questions on the literacy test. Imagine, while many are afraid that white men will burn our houses, shoot into them, or put us off their property, a blind man, 70 years old, wants to come to our meetings. As the summer of 1964 approached, SNCC and other civil rights groups, working together in Mississippi and facing increasing violence, decided to call upon young people from other parts of the country for help. They hoped that would bring attention to the situation in Mississippi. Again and again in Mississippi and elsewhere, the FBI had stood by, lawyers for the Justice Department had stood by, while civil rights workers were beaten and jailed, while federal laws were violated. On the eve of the Mississippi summer, in early June 1964, the civil rights movement rented a theater near the White House, and a busload of black Mississippians traveled to Washington to testify publicly about the daily violence, the dangers facing the volunteers coming into Mississippi. Constitutional lawyers testified that the national government had the legal power to give protection against such violence. The transcript of this testimony was given to President Johnson and Attorney General Kennedy, accompanied by a request for a protective federal presence during the Mississippi summer. There was no response. 12 days after the public hearing, three civil rights workers, James Cheney, a young black Mississippian, and two white volunteers, Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner, were arrested in Philadelphia, Mississippi, released from jail at night, then seized, beaten with chains, and shot to death. Ultimately, an informer's testimony led to jail sentences for the sheriff and deputy sheriff and others. That came too late. The Mississippi murders had taken place after the repeated refusal of the national government, under Kennedy or Johnson, or any other president, to defend blacks against violence. Dissatisfaction with the national government intensified. Later that summer, during the Democratic National Convention in Washington, Mississippi, blacks asked to be seated as part of the state delegation to represent the 40% of the state's population who were black. They were turned down by the liberal Democratic leadership, including vice presidential candidate Hubert Humphrey. Congress began reacting to the black revolt, the turmoil, the world publicity. Civil rights laws were passed in 1957, 1960, and 1964. They promised much on voting equality, unemployment equality, but were enforced poorly or ignored. In 1965, President Johnson sponsored and Congress passed an even stronger voting rights law, this time ensuring on-the-spot federal protection of the right to register and vote. The effect on Negro voting in the South was dramatic. In 1952, 1 million Southern blacks, 20% of those eligible, registered to vote. In 1964, the number was 2 million, 40%. By 1968, it was 3 million, 60%, the same percentage as white voters. The federal government was trying, without making fundamental changes, to control an explosive situation, to channel anger into the traditional cooling mechanism of the ballot box, the polite petition, the officially endorsed quiet gathering. When black civil rights leaders planned a huge march on Washington in the summer of 1963 to protest the failure of the nation to solve the race problem, it was quickly embraced by President Kennedy and other national leaders and turned into a friendly assemblage. Martin Luther King's speech there thrilled 200,000 black and white Americans. "I have a dream." It was magnificent oratory, but without the anger that many blacks felt. When John Lewis, a young Alabama-born SNCC leader, much arrested, much beaten, tried to introduce a stronger note of outrage at the meeting, he was censored by the leaders of the march, who insisted he omit certain sentences critical of the national government and urging militant action. 18 days after the Washington gathering, almost as if in deliberate contempt for its moderation, a bomb exploded in the basement of a black church in Birmingham, and 4 girls attending a Sunday school class were killed. President Kennedy had praised the deep fervor and quiet dignity of the march, but the black militant Malcolm X was probably closer to the mood of the black community. Speaking in Detroit, 2 months after the March on Washington and the Birmingham bombing, Malcolm X said, in his powerful, icy clear, rhythmic style, "The Negroes were out there in the streets. They were talking about how they were going to march on Washington, that they were going to march on Washington, march on the Senate, march on the White House, march on the Congress, and tie it up, bring it to a halt, not let the government proceed. They even said they were going out to the airport and lay down on the runway and not let any airplanes land." I'm telling you what they said. That was revolution. That was revolution. That was the black revolution. It was the grassroots out there in the street. It scared the white man to death. Scared the white power structure in Washington, D.C. to death. I was there. When they found out that this black steamroller was going to come down on the Capitol, they called in these national Negro leaders that you respect and told them, "Call it off," Kennedy said. "Look, you all are letting this thing go too far." And old Tom said, "Boss, I can't stop it because I didn't start it." I'm telling you what they said. They said, "I'm not even in it, much less at the head of it." They said, "These Negroes are doing things on their own. They're running ahead of us." And that old shrewd fox, he said, "If you all aren't in it, I'll put you in it. I'll put you at the head of it. I'll endorse it. I'll welcome it. I'll help it. I'll join it." This is what they did with the March on Washington. They joined it, became part of it, took it over. And as they took it over, it lost its militancy. It ceased to be angry. It ceased to be hot. It ceased to be uncompromising. Why, it even ceased to be a march. It became a picnic, a circus, nothing but a circus with clowns and all. No, it was a sellout. It was a takeover. They controlled it so tight, they told those Negroes what time to hit town, where to stop, what signs to carry, what song to sing, what speech they could make, and what speech they couldn't make, and then told them to get out of town by sundown. The accuracy of Malcolm X's caustic description of the March on Washington is corroborated in the description from the other side, from the establishment, by White House advisor Arthur Schlesinger in his book 1,000 Days. He tells how Kennedy met with the civil rights leaders and said the march would create an atmosphere of intimidation, just when Congress was considering civil rights bills. A. Philip Randolph replied, "The Negroes are already in the streets. It is very likely impossible to get them off." Schlesinger says, "The conference with the president did persuade the civil rights leaders that they should not lay siege to Capitol Hill." Schlesinger describes the Washington March admiringly and then concludes, "So in 1963, Kennedy moved to incorporate the Negro Revolution into the Democratic coalition." but it did not work. The blacks could not be easily brought into the democratic coalition when bombs kept exploding in churches, when new civil rights laws did not change the root condition of black people. In the spring of 1963, the rate of unemployment for whites was 4.8%. For non-whites, it was 12.1%. According to government estimates, one-fifth of the white population was below the poverty line, and one-half of the black population was below that line. The civil rights bills emphasized voting, but voting was not a fundamental solution to racism or poverty. In Harlem, blacks who had voted for years still lived in rat-infested slums.